Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
This is The Athletic Baseball Show on the Athletic Podcast Network.
That is hammered! Oh my!
Man, that ball got out of here in a hurry. You know, anything travels that far, I'd have a damn stewardess on it, don't you think?
High drive! Left field! It is out of here!
This is a simple game. You throw the ball, you hit the ball, you catch the ball. You got it!
You're listening to The Roundtable with Grant Brisby and Andy McCullough on the Athletic Podcast Network.
Welcome to episode 5 of The Roundtable. I'm Grant Brisby. I'm here with Andy McCullough, and we have a guest today, Evan Drellick, who is kind enough to join us. And we're going to talk about just things happening in baseball. We have topics to go with. Today we're going to start with Robinson Cano, because Andy, you slacked me earlier and you said you wanted to talk about Cano because you wanted to hand it to Steve Cohen.
Yes, you are. You are, Grant. Right. Actually, you are. That's what's happening. I asked the question, do you ever have to hand it to them? Not you must hand it to him, but do you ever have to hand it to the ownership class? I don't know if that's really the case here, to be honest, because I think Cohen is so significantly wealthy that, you know, $39 million is not a major expenditure for him. But I guess what I'm wondering is, like, if the sort of, as we've talked about before on the show, like, if the craven nature of some of the other owners has obscured what their actual capabilities are when it comes to financial eating money. And you know, for the context, right, like the Mets had a roster crunch this week, as all teams did, because it was the Mets. It was like a three to seven day news cycle about whether or not it would be, you know, Dom Smith, the very well-liked but sort of part-time bench bat, or Robinson Cano, who's also well-liked within his clubhouse, but is very unproductive as a hitter. This year is coming off a year-long suspension for PED use, and looked just about cooked at the plate. So it was basically, you know, are the Mets going to demote a popular young player, or are they going to eat the money? They ate the money and got rid of Cano. And so I'm just going to wondering, you know, and Evan has dealt with the labor stuff for so long now, if there ever is a time when you do have to hand it to ownership.
It felt like he was doing something that benefits – this benefits his team. It's not benefiting labor necessarily. It's a sunk cost, right? I took a microecon class in college. Don't remember much of it. Great thing for a business of baseball writer to admit. But I do remember sunk costs. And I think that's what we would accurately describe Robinson Cano to be. I think you would hand it to an owner for recognizing that holding on to your really expensive investment that's not performing well isn't a good idea, and that some other owners would be more stubborn and thereby hurt their baseball team. Does that answer your question?
Not really.
I think there's a perspective shift for me because I'm of the era of like the 2000s, that blog mentality where everyone was parroting the same thing on the message boards at all times. And so it was sunk cost fallacy, sunk cost fallacy, sunk cost fallacy. And you would read that in every blog and every comment over and over until like it just became almost like a given. So the idea is that the Mets owed Robinson Cano $41 million, right, over the next 2 years, give or take, based on how much the Mariners were paying. I can't remember the exact number. But so you can pay him $41 million, or you can pay another player essentially $41 million plus the minimum salary. You're paying basically the same thing either way, but you are going to get more production from the second player if you don't believe in Robinson Cano. And so the sunk cost is like, you're never going to get that money back. You just, are you going to pay for production X or production Y? And if it's the same amount, you're going to want production Y. And it just seems like such a given to me. It's like, once you've decided that Robinson Cano is not going to be productive, it's like, I don't understand why it's controversial with owners. And it still is. Like, there still are some owners who are like, no, I'm not going to cut this guy. I'm paying him $41 million. And I just don't understand why it's that hard of a concept to grasp.
Hold on. The best part of the show is when we talk about baseball writing from 15 years ago. What was the sunk cost fallacy that they were like blogging about on FJM?
It was just like, are you going to pay this guy to be unproductive, or are you going to pay basically the same amount for production? Like, the money's gone. It's a sunk cost. Okay. It is just gone. So do you want production or no production? That was kind of the sunk cost fallacy.
Okay, thank you. Evan, continue.
It could have been different if Cohen had signed him, right? These guys get attached to the players that they actually sign. But I also think, I guess it's safe to say that every Major League Baseball owner is to some degree ruthless. Like, even if they inherited some amount of the money as opposed to accumulating that, to accumulate the wealth needed to buy a baseball team, you have to be ruthless. Not everybody who owns a baseball team accumulated that wealth themselves. Steve Cohen has accumulated more wealth than any of the other baseball owners, and therefore is probably the most ruthless baseball owner. And so if anybody's going to do it, A, yes, it is because he has the money, but B, you don't get to the amount of money he has without being really cold and capable of a lot of things. And I think that would include cutting a big name baseball player that you didn't sign. That's what I would expect from the guy who's made $10 billion.
I don't disagree with you. I do wonder, though, like, why do you think it is that there are so many people who have that sort of ruthless ability to accumulate this money, but that doesn't translate into trying to win in an industry? Like, why does it only translate into accumulating wealth through that? I mean, maybe that's how they view winning. Maybe it's simple as that, right?
The more money you get, the less you want to part with it. Basically, I think it's pretty simple at the end of the day. Certainly, it wouldn't harm any of these people in their day-to-day lives if they spent more on their rosters. But yeah, there's a social element too, right? If you are the guy who breaks the norm and makes it harder for the other owners, they'll put in a tax for your name, right? They will do what they can to deter you from spending. It's its own little social club. So it's not as simple as the rational, pragmatic cost-benefit analysis. It's, you know, what are you supposed to do to please your peers, to please the commissioner's office, who ultimately wants to please your peers?
I will offer a medium spicy take, and I don't know, slap me if this is incorrect, but I think that 41 at-bats for Cano is not the biggest sample. I get that he's 39, but he was really good in 2020. He was good in the spring. 39 years old is old for a player, not necessarily old for a Hall of Famer or a Hall of Fame adjacent player. I get that he is coming off a suspension where you maybe those 2020 numbers are illegitimate. I think it might be too early. Is there a possibility that someone's going to swoop him up? Like, was this a sunk cost? Like, was this like the proper definition of, yeah, this guy's a total drag, we got to get rid of him right now?
The issue is that it was taking away at-bats from Dom Smith. So because of that, there was just less utility on the roster. So it has less to do with, like, I'm sort of with you, Grant. Like, you know, I've long had this theory about the dead cat bounce, that, you know, sort of elite dead cats will bounce higher and longer than others, right? Because, like, they have that, you know, that amount of talent. So I think in a vacuum, 40 at-bats is probably too few for Cano, but the issue in this specific case is that in order to keep him around, on chance that he picks it up, you're significantly hampering Dom Smith, who, you know, is much younger, is theoretically part of the future here, whether it's, you know, as a contributor or trying to boost his trade value. And so it's just from a roster construction sense, it didn't make sense to keep him around.
So in the early aughts blog wars, this is known as opportunity cost. And this is what we yelled about at all times in the blog. All right, go ahead, Evan.
I looked up Cano's numbers before coming on the program because I thought I should just have some awareness of what they were because I didn't previously. And it did jump out at me as somebody who is not, you know, going backwards and covering the Mets day to day as Andy is. Although who knows what the future holds for me.
Give it time.
That 12 games was probably a low amount. And then the assumption I made in my head is, well, they must have some underlying numbers that I'm not going to bother looking up right now on that I would have, you know, if I was a beat writer, you know, the StatCast and other analytics that we could.
The at bat quality was not
right. That even
lots
even
of strikeouts, lots of ground outs, you know, not a lot of hard.
So there you go. That's the answer.
Does anyone care about spring training anymore? Is it all just looking at the quality of at bats? Like, I know that stats don't matter, but if he's having good quality at bats against the 41st player on a 40-man roster, does anyone care about that?
I don't think spring training's mattered for like 10 years, and I think we just figured that out like 3 years ago.
I also think a little more urgency early in the year is smart because, like, it always annoyed me as a beat writer when people go, it's early. It's early, you know, it's okay, what's the game in April? And it's like, you know, at the end of the season, whatever's going to happen is probably going to come down to like three or four games. And that game in April, you can sit there and go, well, you know, if you had tried harder or made a smarter decision, you would have not been in this position now. So it's not really addressing spring training, but I do think well, just let them keep playing it out. No, this game counts as much as every game counts.
And while the Mets they've played very good baseball thus far, they are in first place, you know, the Braves are legit. And so this is not a situation like, you know, the 2017 Dodgers who are going to finish, you know, like 20 games ahead of the second place club. Like this is a tough division. So you got to show some muscle. And so they did.
I will say that there's a difference in my head between April games matter. I acknowledge that. They are just as important. They are going to come down to whatever happens in April, May. It's all, you know, it matters the same. At the same time, I have no idea what's actually going on. And so anything I write, any opinion I have is me exposing myself as a fraud or just, you know, just I have no idea what to actually believe. If I'm going to believe in Robinson Cano's slump or if I'm going to believe that the Marlins are maybe better than we gave them credit for. Like, I just don't know. And that's always the April curse for me is pretending like I know when I don't know.
I'm actually writing a column about this for the day this comes out, Wednesday, in which I have this this quote from Braves general manager Alex Anthopoulos. Why are you writing a column about the state of the National League East after 3 weeks? So you can check that out in The Athletic today, Wednesday. The premise is like all these games count, but they don't really matter, if that makes sense. They count in the standings, and obviously they will. There will be an accounting of that at the end, but like in terms of drawing conclusions from them, it's a fool's errand.
They matter in the standings, but not in the narrative. Is that a good writerly way to put it?
It's hack to point out like the Nationals from 2 years ago, you know, like where or 3 years ago, whatever it was, 2019, where they were after, you know, however many games, 40 games, 45 games, 50 games, you know, where San Diego was like 20 games over 500 at some point last year. You know, it's you won't believe this. It's a long season, Grant. It really is. They often say it's not a sprint, it's a marathon.
Now it's my turn to write things down. Not a sprint, a marathon. Is that a running analogy?
Kind of, yeah, yeah. We're educating Evan on how the game works. He's got the business down.
He also learned something about running. That would probably be good for my health going forward.
You look good.
I got on the Peloton today, so.
Yeah, do you mind me disclosing?
No, that's okay. That's all right, yeah.
Evan, you are coming back from COVID, so the fatigue is real. Is that right?
I had the symptoms, you know, like felt like a bad sinus infection really got me for several days there. But now those are gone, and all I'm left with is an unwavering desire to sleep, particularly in the late afternoon, early evening hours. So real napping.
I think it's early afternoon.
Late afternoon. I say early, I meant late afternoon.
A lot of people use this podcast to go to sleep, so this must be especially hard for you just to contribute to that. All right, we are going to move on. We're going to move on to, I got to say, this is one of the most exhausting topics. It's an important topic. But as far as I can't believe we're dealing with this topic again, the baseball, the actual composition of the baseball, again, like the Black Obelisk in 2001, A Space Odyssey, and we're hopping around it like apes, like, oh, this is, how could this, where did this come from? We're talking about the composition of the baseball again. And Andy made a good point. Can't this be collectively bargained? And now that we have a business of baseball writer, please tell us if this can, should, will be collectively bargained.
Yeah, so it requires a little bit of specificity. There is a rule, and the playing rules are collectively bargained, right? So there is something about the ball that is collectively bargained. But you could take it a step further and ask, well, could the players say that literally any change in the production protocols that MLB advises Rawlings or tells Rawlings to make, and they own Rawlings, by the way, or you know, Peter Seidler, who's the Padres, it's all part of MLB at this point. Could the players go for that? Theoretically, technically, yes. The answer that I was getting back in, remember Insider and Bradford Davis, they had the big story, I don't know if it was November or December, somewhere around there, in the middle of bargaining about the ball and whether MLB was using one ball, they found they were using two balls. And the answer I got at the time for, well, why aren't you trying to collectively bargain the ball now during bargaining while it was ongoing, is that basically they had bigger fish to fry in their eyes, in the overall collection of the players' union eyes. And you can sit there and go, that was wrong, right? That maybe they should have made that a priority. But if you're MLB, you don't ever really want to give up control of anything, right? No management group wants to just say, yeah, okay, now all of a sudden I'm giving my employees a new say in something. And so there might have had to have been a sacrifice for players to gain that added control. That said, within all this, okay, they are in communication over the ball. And there's kind of two issues with the ball. There's the actual construction of the ball. Then there's this question of, do they have a universally approved sticky substance that MLB is trying to develop? So it's not like there isn't any collaboration and discussion between MLB and the union about the ball. But yeah, intuitively, could the players ask for more control over the exact process? I think they could. Would they get anywhere? Would they have to give up something to get to it? That's the rub usually in collective bargaining.
I know you don't believe in horse trading, but that sounds
that's
like
some horse trading right there. Yes,
horse
that
trading.
Is horse trading.
So in order to get that on the table, they'd have to say like, all right, fine, give us back the qualifying offer or something.
Yeah,
like that.
Probably not the trade you want to make, but yeah.
I mean, well, you know, look, I've been told it's an important issue because the ball is used on every play.
Yeah, well, you know, I texted, I don't think Ken would mind this. I was talking with Ken with this about this with Ken briefly this morning, because I wondered if he had heard anything to the question of, why hasn't this been collectively bargained? He made a point, which is that, well, pitchers and hitters could have different interests, right? And so if you got to the point of the players trying to say, well, we want the ball to be more or less bouncy, right, and fly farther, well, that might be a tricky one for the players union to legislate. Speculatively, I think it's a reasonable point of speculation. But yeah, you're right, Andy, that would be horse trading. And we did, and you're referring back to my point that horse trading isn't always what drives collective bargaining, and I don't think it is. But we did see in the bargaining that just ended, you know, the players gave more control to the commissioner's office to make rule changes, and then the players got some things. But there was bargaining. There was trading.
I am but a humble American who has a car that needs repairing and a house that needs painting. However, it seems to me that if I owned a team or was involved in running a league, when you had those stories come out where like Shohei Ohtani is saying, here's the baseball from Japan, isn't this pretty cool? And all the pitchers go, oh, heck yeah, that's cool. I would think that as an owner or a member of the ownership class, I would listen and think, well, players seem to like that baseball. That might make the product better. It shouldn't have to be horse trading. Explain to me why I'm dumb and naive on this specific subject.
The league, as it stands now, right, without it, without kind of an additional layer of bargaining over this topic, right, there's the rule that says the playing ball has to be this. The league is in communication with the union now about what they're trying to do with the substance and kind of the feel of the baseball. But if you're going to give up the authority, the actual kind of final say, and make that a shared final say, usually people don't want to give up that right, no matter what it is, right? I mean, it's kind of the difference between any workplace that has a union and doesn't, right? Like, and then what topics do you, you know, there are mandatory subjects of bargaining, and there are those that are not, that they're permissive subjects that you just decide, okay, I will bargain over this. But MLB could sit there and go, we don't have to bargain over this, and then the players would have to, you know, it's its own fight. It's just, unfortunately in labor, it's just never quite that simple.
But even if it seems pretty clear that happy baseball players, when it comes to the baseball, the composition of the baseball, would make for a better product, that doesn't seem like it's controversial. Even with that, it always comes down to negotiation and what are you going to give up? And no, we hold this right. And
so I think that's what MLB is doing, is they're trying to find a ball that makes players happy. But you can do that without saying, I give you an actual authoritative veto.
Have they considered a ball made of service time? Have they considered a ball made of playoff shares?
I don't know definitively what change MLB could make to the ball as far as like the actual feel and grip as the rules stand now with the players without some input from the players, right? Like I'd have to read the exact rule. We could do that live on the air here. I don't know that that would be good for people. You know, there is some already some, the players have their talents into the construction of the ball to some degree. Like, okay, weird scenario. MLB is like, screw you. We're putting in this surface of the ball. We're changing it. And we're not going to ask for your input at all. If MLB decided to do that, which they're not going to do that. Could the players right now, as the rules stand, go, you can't do that because of the fact that it is slightly collectively bargained because it's in the playing rules right now. I don't know. I think that's not a practical discussion because they are in communication. It's just that it is still, at the end of the day, not something the players have full control over, clearly.
Well, maybe it's hard to put the toothpaste back in the tube.
That's what I'm, because, yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, we did not have these conversations in 2016, 2015, 2014, right? It was oh, offense is up, offense is down. It was really the reintroduction of the rabbit ball that brought this to attention. And maybe now we are never going back because we have the StatCast data. We can look at, well, the drag, the balls aren't traveling. Exit velocity means this year and not what it did last year. It's possible that you're right, that there is just never going to be the middle porridge ball.
The thing that stands out to me, I think I wrote a column kind of about this already 2 or 3 years ago, the kind of the lack of trust that MLB has engendered with the ball. There's really two options. MLB is either massively corrupt and just changing the ball on a whim. And I'm not ruling that out. I'm not saying it's true, but you know, that's one choice. The other choice is they're basically incompetent, have no control over the construction of the ball. And then from there, it's a question of how generous of a reading do you want to give that? Should they have realized sooner that, oh, we really can't control this thing? Or do you look at it and give some grace because, well, StatCast has only developed in recent years and you know our understanding of exactly how the ball moves has only advanced in recent years, that, well, we cut them some slack here. And that's really up to the reader, the listener, the eye, the beholder, whether you want to kind of be generous with the fact that they can't control their manufacturing process. Because that's the answer at the end of the day. It's either they're really corrupt and they're willfully changing it to suit whatever they desire at the moment, or they simply cannot control it. And I don't think either is necessarily good. It depends how generous you want to be.
I know that there was like some, you know, Pete Alonso had some hooking theory a couple of years ago about how like, oh, they've deadened the balls because this year's class of free agents is, you know, a bunch of good hitters. And it's like, come on, man. Like these guys can't, there's conspiracy shit. These guys can't even get the Angels in the playoffs.
That's actually a different kind of razor. There's Occam's razor, but then there's Hanlon's razor. This is also from my mid-2000s blog experience. Hanlon's razor is never a tribute to malice, that which can adequately be explained by stupidity. I agree with that because I do think that the ball, it seems simple, but it's not. The manufacturing, the sourcing, the production, there are so many things that do go into it, producing them at scale. I just think it wasn't much of an issue before, and now that it's a constant issue every year, they're scrambling to figure it out, and that's just how it's going to be for the foreseeable future, I think.
people vest too much power and faith and confidence in leaders in all sorts of places, but clearly inside of in baseball, right? It's a $10 billion industry, so you think, oh, they know exactly what they're doing all the time. And by the way, you can have a combination of malice and incompetence. It's certainly possible to have both working at the same time. You don't want to rule that out either. But I do kind of, I think in this role where I often am dealing with the commissioner's office and the players union and these kind of the decisions those people on those levels are making, I do step back and like I have a thought about the commissioner sometimes. It's like, you know, at the end of the day, this guy's just a lawyer. He's a lawyer in a very prominent position. But that's it, right? He's a lawyer who's made his way to a certain role, and there's a lot of lawyers in the world. And you know, to think that means that he has incredible foresight or perfect decision making, no. And that's the same for the other people in his office, same for people at the players' union on down. It's just these are not people of perfection, unlike the three of us.
Well, I can give an example that hits pretty close to home. The New York Times recently paid $550 million for a company that would give a podcast to Andy and myself. It's not good. It's not, you know, like that just doesn't look good on them.
To be fair, though, the show hadn't been aired yet.
Oh, that's true. Okay. So we're at this back end of them.
They bought Wordle, and then they were like, all right, well, got that, and now let's do the round table.
Let me ask you, is there a certain type of baseball romance that comes with the eras shifting and one year being different from the other? Thinking about 1968, and oh, that's the year of the dominance of the pitcher, in remembering 1987, and that's the year of the rabbit ball. Is that kind of part of the romance of baseball, is having these ups and downs, and oh, home runs are flying all over the place, now they're not? Is that something that fans have come to expect a little bit?
Well, it explains the history of the sport, but I'd have to go back and read the coverage. Like, were the hitters whining about the size of the mound in, like, 1968, you know, the height of the mound? That's the aspect that, for me, I'll never complain about guys saying interesting things. I just wonder, it's like you said, the toothpaste out of the tube aspect of, like, there's always going to be someone winning. Like, frankly, they might be right, you know? It might be that, you know, baseball's contributing to all the hit-by pitches because they're the I think it's more likely because guys have no idea where they're throwing the ball anymore. They gear up and throw hard every single time, and you know the minors have been gutted in a way that like Elton has done. But yeah, I mean, it's certainly part of it. I don't know. I mean, I don't. I guess we should all be lucky enough to get there where we can talk about the romance of the 2019, you know, baseball season, like the year Brett Gardner hit like 35 home runs or something. I don't know. I'm not there yet.
I'm sure other people are paying more attention than I am. But, you know, like you go back to like 2010, I remember it was kind of the year of the pitcher. 2000 to 2010, this was not as much a topic as I recall. And I was a pretty big baseball fan, and I was already, you know, late in that decade, started to work professionally. Now it's like every year it's going in one direction for half the season. It's just kind of a mess. Where I'm not identifying any single season anymore with a certain ball type. Maybe some people are doing that more readily than I am. But like, I don't think I'm going to look back and go, oh, 2018, that was the year the ball was like this for half the year. And then the other half of the year was it doesn't feel productive to me in the way that 1968 we remember. And I don't know if productive is the right word, but it's a jumbled mess now.
I think that's an excellent point, because when you get to September or October and you have an article from Eno saying, oh, guess what? They pulled the old switcheroo on the postseason baseballs. Isn't that quirky? That is not quirky. That drives me nuts. I just can't believe that we're just talking about the baseball composition again.
It's so boring.
Forever.
So boring.
It's important. It's boring, but it's important and it's the story of the game, but it's also, it makes me want to tear what's left of my hair out.
I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but I always have to think about, well, why could something be one way and not another way? And the one question that does occasionally pop into my mind is, what don't they want us to talk about and would rather us talk about the ball in place of? Why do they always want us talking about the baseball instead of other what topics are we supposed to be ignoring? I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I'm just asking the question.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
If you're as obsessed with basketball as I am, then you know there's no better time of year than the NBA playoffs. Hey guys, this is JJ Redick. Twice a week, I'm cooking up something special for basketball junkies on my podcast, The Old Man and the Three. I bring on guests in all stages of their careers to talk about the league and share stories you won't hear anywhere else, like Devin Booker on why he talks so much trash, or Paolo Banchero on his shooting workouts with Kevin Durant, Ray Allen's epic free throw competitions with LeBron when they were teammates in Miami. But it's not just about the player interviews. Every Monday, I break down the top three things happening around the NBA without the outlandish takes. Often joined by masterminds of the game like Tim Legler, we dive deep into topics like rookie reports, trade breakdowns, and why is mean mugging now a tech? The Old Man and the Three is the only companion podcast you'll need during the playoffs this year. Be sure to listen to The Old Man and the Three ad-free on Wondery Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's the little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Visit DirecTV.com. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
All right, we're going to move on to the subject that I had to do a lot of research on because this is not something, when it came out, I wasn't paying that close attention to it at all. So I had to, for my own edification, look some things up. The infamous Yankees letter. And specifically, this was released because of a lawsuit, and everyone got to see the letter that, Major League Baseball sent to the Yankees. It was described in some circles as a nothing burger, which is maybe my least favorite phrase of all time. But it seems like the reaction was muted. Is this the end of sign stealing? Is it closed? Are we just going to remember what happened in the past? I don't know. I'm going to turn it over to you guys.
It wasn't a nothing. However, it didn't exactly say anything particularly that you guys hadn't already reported. So why did they fight it so hard? Like, I feel like this was really like a Streisand effect in that it made it seem like a big deal when if they had just released it. I don't know. You talk, Evan.
It's possible that the Yankees and Major League Baseball did a pretty good job with their PR effort here, and people just didn't have the stomach or interest in kind of parsing it. There are two questions to look at. The first one and the one I think that got the most attention was, is this any different than what the Yankees were doing, any different than what we knew them to be doing? And when we say what we knew them to be doing, we are including the reporting Ken Rosenthal and I did, right? Ken Rosenthal and I in 2020 explained to you that they were using their video room this way. And I do not believe anybody had previously reported that. And so, no, the letter does not reveal behavior that was not previously known to the public. If you ask the other question, a different question, which is, does it reveal something different than what MLB explained to the world? And does it show any inconsistencies between the way MLB wanted to disseminate it separate of reporters and what they actually knew was going on? Yeah. If you look back at this press release, this statement that Commissioner Manfred put out in 17, there's a paragraph in there that's describing what the Yankees are doing. And I swear, my guess would be if you were to hand it to 20 baseball fans and say, just read this passage, tell me what the Yankees were up to that year. No one would have an understanding that they were using their video room as a means of stealing signs and had,
because they framed it about the phone, right?
The press release reads pretty differently than that letter to Brian Cashman. I think that's what Major League Baseball is afraid of. The significance of the letter is that you have, for the first time, MLB saying on the record, the Yankees were doing this. The Yankees were using their video room to steal signs, which is something that, lo and behold, right after the letter, MLB decided it was going to punish, right? So the Astros get punished for that in addition to the garbage can scheme. You know, the Astros are doing two things. It's the video room and the garbage can thing. And that's exactly what the Red Sox are doing then in 18 as well. And so there's also this historical significance to this letter and what it does and doesn't do, right? Because the whole point of what Manfred is trying to do in September of 17, you have the Red Sox and Yankees both using their video rooms to steal signs, which is not a point that Manfred made explicitly at the time. It does talk about it more with the Red Sox and the Yankees. The whole point of it is deterrence. You're trying to tell the rest of the league, this has got to stop, right? And to that extent, in that effort, Manfred miserably failed.
If your point is deterrence, right? Why didn't the press release in 17 with the Apple Watch scandal, why didn't they say they're using the video rooms to break signs and send them in through the phone and then signal them out? And, you know, that's illegal in the final. As you know, there's a lot of smoke on plenty of other teams doing similar things who have been accused. So, like, why didn't they just do that?
Right, because they are scandal averse. They didn't want, a month before the postseason started, you have two playoff-bound teams, Red Sox and Yankees, who, under a reasonable interpretation of the rule. The rule at the time, the rule was not as good as it should have been. It was very broad. That's the league's fault. That's the commissioner's office's fault. But it did say you can't use electronic equipment for the purpose of stealing signs, right? That's pretty clear. And what is video replay equipment? It is electronic equipment. And so I think they realized that if they explained everything that was going on, they might have had some people going, "What? This is a little weird that you're not reading it this way." And you know, the purpose of the Department of Investigations has always been to kind of quell public clamor. It's, you know, it's not this Department of Justice, and even then that the DOJ is political, right? Like it exists to further the interests of Major League Baseball. The interests of Major League Baseball in September of 2017 were not to have a massive scandal with the Red Sox and Yankees. It was to get to the postseason where they make the most money and have people believe in the sport. But the mistake there was Manfred thinking that people were going to listen to him. That if all you did was fine the Red Sox and the Yankees and don't actually explain what was going on, why would the Astros stop? I'm not absolving the Astros. Why wouldn't the Red Sox the next year keep going? If you want to imagine the other teams are doing it too, why wouldn't another team use their video room at that point? It's not good management on Manfred's part.
Does this fall into the malevolence or incompetence file?
I would tend toward the latter. But lack of transparency over what's going on. I mean, reading the way he explained, Manfred explained to Brian Cashman in that private letter what the Yankees are doing compared to what he tried to explain to the public. That's the thing I think a lot of the other writers just didn't seem to grasp or care about or think about, right? Everybody was trying to answer this question of, well, does it reveal anything different than what we already knew or what is it the same as what the Astros are doing? No. Does it show something that MLB clearly wanted to keep away from the public? Yeah. Yes, it does.
I'm coming to this with like a little bit fresh eyes because I haven't been boning up on this.
The Giants weren't good in 2017. So
right.
Grant,
I'm just in a bubble.
Was checked out.
No, I just sort of was. So I was like going through and I was going through the timeline and what the letter says and what the $100,000 fine was the Yankees were relaying information in real time, right? And that is a big distinction. You're relaying strike or pitch calling information in real time. In September 2017, there's a letter that says, hey, stop it. I'm serious this time. You know, there's a Manfred letter that says, cut it out. And my thought was, why would the Astros look at that and go, gosh, everyone's going to take this super seriously. We better cut it out. Everyone, like, this is really stern. I don't think it was like that. And I don't want to be sympathetic to the Astros. At the same time, it's, why would they think that, well, we'd better knock it off?
Just one point. The notion of real time, the term all the stuff gets very convoluted. You know, they were getting the sign sequence out to, right? So you know, they would know that, okay, they're using three signs and it's the middle sign. So guy puts down 1, 2, 3, it's 2. That's the sign. We know what the indicator is. As opposed to what the Astros are doing with the garbage can, which is literally telling, as the pitch was called, exactly what pitch was coming. You can argue whether people should look at these things differently. I think most people do look at them differently. They're still both cheating and using electronics to cheat. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of questions connected to the Astros scandal. And one of them is, well, what did management and enforcement and the commissioner's office have to do with the development of that scandal, separate of what was going on inside of Houston, or, you know, in conjunction with what was going on inside of Houston? And there was a Ken Rosenthal column, and I was there for this interview in 2020 in spring training, where you know, Manfred acknowledges, I think as much as he has really at any point, that he screwed up, that he wishes he regrets not dealing with sign stealing sooner. It's one of the things that they, with the video rooms, you know, when Manfred takes over, he's making this big public push to modernize the game, technology, technology, technology. And this is this commissioner who is the veteran of the PED wars, right? Like, understands and was involved with PEDs and the way players behave and their pursuit of gaining an edge as much as anybody in this sport. And then is front and center with handing over these technological keys to the players and has virtually no awareness of what's going to come from that. And, you know, it is an irony of the whole thing, right? It is not absolving the Astros for what they did. You know, when people say that letter is a nothing burger, you got to understand the importance of that decision in September 2017, how it plays into everything else, how it did not accomplish what he was trying to accomplish, and how it is, in fact, a different wording and telling of what was going on than what the league put out publicly at the time. You know, and so, no, I don't think it's a nothing burger, but it does take, you got to sink your teeth into it to kind of get there. Like a nice, juicy, you know, burger.
So it's like an impossible.
Yeah, I like impossible better than beyond. Have you had both at this point?
Should I?
Yeah, you can just try it.
Yeah. You get it like at the store?
No, restaurants have them. I think the stores have them now.
I wouldn't do that at a restaurant.
Well, they know what they're doing. They prepare, you know, I think it's more interesting to do it at a restaurant because then you could see, do they make it taste like a regular burger?
You know, obviously you got a lot of credit for breaking the Astros scandal. But, you know, not enough people talk about how I broke the Apple Watch scandal, actually, in 2015 when Ned Yost was caught wearing an Apple Watch in the Royals dugout. And I called the commissioner's office to ask if it was if he was allowed to wear it because he could transmit signals. And they took it away from him, and he was mad because it was a gift from Major League Baseball at the All-Star game.
Wasn't that keeping track of his heart rate and blood pressure? Didn't you almost kill him?
He said that he turned it off. Like, all it was doing, yeah, okay, away from the dugout, Yost said he only uses the watch to catalog his exercise goals during the day. He can also check the weather. Yost received a watch from Major League Baseball as a gift at the All-Star game. He says this is entrapment. So he gives up the watch, come into his office a couple days later. He's got this huge, like, $10,000 timepiece that this, like, Kansas City company just gave to him. And he goes, "How you like my watch?" And so he just got two free watches.
It's good to be a baseball manager.
Ned is at a charm.
You know, the irony of the Apple Watch scandal is that, as I understand it, I believe I think somebody reported it. It might have been late Nick Cafardo. But as I understand it, there was no Apple Watch involved. It was a Fitbit. It was a different make of wearable device.
It was a
Fitbit? Yeah. The device that the Red Sox trainer was wearing in what became known as the Apple Watch scandal did not actually involve an Apple branded watch.
It was a Fitbit. That's incredible.
Was it like one of those, like, the Donkey Kong watches that you would wear and kind of poke around? Like a Fitbit?
It was a Tamagotchi.
Yeah. you can't do anything with a Fitbit. All right.
Hold on real quick. I mean, so Evan, like, your book will come out, and I assume you're going to have some new stuff in there, right? That'll probably generate some interest. But like, are we going to live in this perpetually? Like, every couple years, we're going to be talking about this period of time, like the fall of 2017.
I think the Astros stuff will linger for, you know, I don't think people are going to soon forget what the Astros did. The interesting question is probably, does the pitch com, you know, the headset thing become fully widely adopted? And then, do you have any scandals associated with that? Do you have any team that says they were jamming our system, or they were, you know, somehow cracking that code? Was there technological interference or whatever, right?
Do you think a team would be like sort of crazy enough to try that?
You know, if you don't think you're going to get caught, I wouldn't put much past any of these people anymore.
But I guess this is the whole thing with the Astros scandal. It's kind of the failure of imagination, right? Like, I think a lot of players at least felt like what the Astros were doing was just technologically impossible and sort of beyond the pale.
Yeah, well, right. I mean, it's the same conversation around the buzzer, right? The notion of a buzzer. And I think it is actually kind of – among the tragedies of all of this is that it does give you reason – now, having seen what the Astros did and were capable of doing, you sit there and you can wonder about anything. And I do, and I have, and I'll continue to, knowing what the Astros did. You know, the example I go back to is the story Ken and I broke about the Astros was published in November of 2019. So this is like 2 or 3 weeks after Altuve hits that home run off Chapman. So I, at the time of Altuve hitting the home run, although the public doesn't know what I know the Astros were cheating in 17, right? I already have that knowledge and we're working on the story. So knowing that, I'm rewinding the Altuve home run, 10 times. You know, I'm sitting on my couch. I watched the Altuve home run. I'm like, did he know it was coming? How did he know it was coming? And I'm not saying I had evidence of it, right? But once you know what you're capable of doing, what these people are capable of doing, it's all about imagination. Who knows what limit they would go to or not go to.
I contrast that with me when I was covering the Dodgers in 2018. There were various people around the organization who were, grousing. Like, you know, the Astros have like a camera on our signs in the World Series. And I'm like, yeah, sure they did, dude.
Whatever you say, man.
This has been episode 5 of the Roundtable. I would like to thank Evan Drellick. That was good stuff. It's nice to have at least one big brain on the show to make up for Andy and myself. So thank you so much for coming on.
You know, I used to be on the radio.
All right. Thank you so much for listening. We will be back next week with more baseball topics and or hot takes. Thanks for listening.